The pair of monks were efficient and did the job with no further comment, leaving Charlie with the impression that their training had been by someone other than a man under Christian discipline. In the end, they dumped him onto the floor of his cell, sprawling him over the stone flags. The light had been turned on again, and someone else had been in the cell since he'd left for Compline. He could scent the man as soon as they left him alone. Banging the door closed, leaving a hint of garlic in their wake. In spite of this, Charlie got the scent of another person. Whoever had been there had swapped the red folder of transcriptions for a new smart blue folder. Apart from the exchange, there were other tiny indications that a stranger had been present. It was as though the air had been disturbed by the stranger's body, leaving a trace, an invisible moulding, and a wake in the cell. Just as the pit viper senses the change in its prey's body temperature, so Charlie's senses tracked an unseen target. The arrogance of the Father Superior made him certain that these monks had secrets and strange links with what he could only think of as an illegal part of society. When you boiled it down, it had to be a matter of money. Wasn't that why he'd put a question mark over the presence of the luxury motor yacht? Was the yacht a conduit? Money in by sea and out via a little Cessna piloted by Hilary Cook with an E. He could still smell the trace of incense in his nostrils, just as he also felt the cold creeping deeply into his bones. He put on the light quilted jacket he'd worn since leaving Heathrow, then wrapped the blanket around himself and stretched out on the bed, doubling the pillow against the iron bedhead and opening the new blue folder. The moment he began reading, Charlie realized that Naomi's narrative had moved to a new, more urgent plane. Jesus is coming into Jerusalem. In a few days it will be the feast of the Passover. Romilius, my lord, this is the feast in which my people celebrate their escape from Egypt, when the angel of death passed over the houses of all Israelites. God punished the Egyptians by causing the death of all firstborn. At that time my people were told to smear blood on their doors, so that the angel of death would not come near them. Nowadays, families band together and celebrate this by sacrificing a lamb, which they eat with unleavened bread, wearing the clothes in which they travel. Passover is one of our holiest festivals, very important to us, and for Jesus to show himself is dangerous. Last night I met the brothers James and John, two of Jesus' followers, and they told me he planned to be in the city. They are both greatly concerned, for they fear Jesus' presence is going to put his life in danger. He has already said he will be taken like a common criminal, for he expects to be arrested and killed. He says things must follow their course, and the prophecies will be fulfilled. A strange thing happened before they left me to travel to Bethany, where Jesus is staying. "Aren't you the girl who anointed the Master with spikenard?" James asked me. "Yes," I told him. "You saw me, you were there." Then as they left, he called me Mary. There is some confusion in his mind, and I did not dare correct him. Later, old Saul, who comes to do heavy work in the house, arrived to see if he could mend the stair to our upper room. He said the whole city is buzzing about the great teacher Jesus, who is coming soon. Some were saying that he is the Messiah, the Christ who has come to set us free, he told me. Charlie turned the page, and unsuspecting was plunged into a new piece of drama. "Romilius, my lord and master, you've only just left me, and I feel dread and fear, for I do not understand why you have asked me to repeat everything to Petros, everything you have just told me. The only reason I can think of is that you know, or at least sense, that your life is in danger. When I asked you if this was so, you would not even speak of it. Please, my lord, please understand that I love you with all my heart, so I'm greatly afraid for you. But I shall do as you ask, and Petros will write it down. You came without warning, and I had no reason to think you had been anywhere near Jesus. Another centurion had been with me, the tall one with the dark hair and the scar, the one whose mother was born in Britannia, whose parents were of that country. He left only just before, and you caught me unaware. You did not want to lie with me, I could see that at once. But I did not expect you to charge me with such a task for the good and safety of Rome. I shall, of course, do what you command, but I plead now that I should be allowed to go to Rome with you, for what I am to do is an honour and also a service to Rome. I am to leave straight away and go to Bethany, where we know the Master, Jesus, is lodged, at the house of the widow Martha. Once there, and speaking to him in private, I have to tell him that I am an emissary from the Roman governor Pontius Pilate. Pilate and the senior officers of the garrison in Jerusalem are disturbed at the news that Jesus is planning to come into the city for Passover. His Excellency the governor fears that the religious leaders of the Israelites will attempt to have Jesus arrested to stand trial. Pilate has no wish to harm the Master. He believes the chief priests and the members of the Sanhedrin would be happy to see Jesus executed by the authorities, who would have to take action against him. Pilate has no reason to hurt the Master, so pleads with him now, do not come into Jerusalem at this time. Doing so will only put you in danger. I leave now, my Lord, to carry out this task. May the Lord God watch over us both. In London, in the Dolphin Square flat, Bex had a second restless night. She could not settle without Charlie, so she made herself a milky drink at bedtime, believing her mother to be right about these things. A milky drink, Horlicks or Ovaltine, will send you to sleep quicker than any sleeping pill, her mum used to say. Just as she also used to say that if you banged your head a set number of times on your pillow, you would wake at the same time as the number. It was rubbish, of course, and Bex found that the milky drink was also rubbish. In her case, anyway. As it was, her mum had turned out to be the carrier of erroneous advice in a number of areas. Nothing good comes of girls who wear black underwear, she had once counselled her daughter, who was willing to prove that excellent and wonderful things did in fact happen to girls who were tarty smart under their frocks. At 2:30, Bex got up. It had happened in exactly the same way on the previous night. Now it was 2:30 on Sunday morning. She got up, put on her long white robe, the one with the hood that Charlie had so admired. He would quote Christopher Robin at her all the time. Mine has a hood, and I lie in bed, and pull the hood right over my head. It was one of Charlie's more endearing traits, quoting from books much loved in childhood. She'd bought him a Folio Society copy of The Wind in the Willows, for instance, and you'd have thought it was a first edition worth thousands. Then she wondered if she'd done the right thing, because he quoted from it interminably. Having got up and swished around the flat in the long robe, she decided to pour herself a stiff, medicinal brandy. She got pissed quickly on brandy, so quite logically she reasoned that it would help her toward temporary oblivion. She looked around for something to occupy her while the alcohol was taking effect, and her eye finally lighted on the stiff envelope full of photographs that Charlie had asked her to send on to him at the monastery. He'd even suggested a profligate act, sending them by courier, which would have been hell's expensive. Maybe that should be her line when she greeted him. You wanted the pictures? Well, I brought them for you. She could do that because nobody there would associate her with the law, unless, of course, Charlie had been indiscreet. Something she thought unlikely. She slit open the envelope and slid the black and white matte prints onto her lap. They were grainy and not of a high quality, and they were all of similar groups of men draped around each other in various states of what she thought of as camaraderie. A very young Charlie Gauntlet figured in each of them, young, innocent-looking, with a military haircut and in uniform, the single pips of a second lieutenant weighing heavily on his shoulders. In most of the prints he stood next to an older officer, a major, tall, slim and slightly forbidding, a kind of warning signal in the pics, there for more than a keepsake. The major was in all the photographs, but most of the other men were different in each picture, picked and mixed, except for a couple of tough guys in uniform, big fellows, tall and muscular, the kind of men who would have drowned cats and pulled the wings off flies. They were policemen, military policemen, wearing the white blancoed gaiters, belts and sidearm holsters with lanyards, snaking from pistol butts to necks. Their stiff-peaked caps square on the head, braided with crimson bands. Both were corporals and looked right bastards, and in some of the photographs they obviously posed with their charges, threadbare men and women, who forced themselves to look happy with unspecified smiles and hard grins. Strangely, it was like looking at contemporary photos of the more dangerous parts of Europe. She remembered a quotation she'd read in one of the Sunday newspaper supplements. A photograph is a secret about a secret. The more it tells you, the less you know. When she had time on Sundays, Bex would assiduously read the newspapers. She saw it as a means to further education. In two of the prints, the same young woman stood between Charlie and the Major, a thin, ferrety woman in an insubstantial grey dress with an old coat thrown around her shoulders. The coat, Bex thought, was there in an attempt to appear racy and sophisticated, but her eyes looked into the camera lens with a terrible used stare, giving a sense of desperate entrapment. Lord, Bex thought, Lord, I hope that wasn't on account of Charlie. You could see from the way she held herself and the blankness of her expression that this girl's life and experience was channeled into pleasing males. Bex could immediately tell that the thin woman was opening her legs regularly for her guards. I wonder, she thought, I wonder if Charlie... Bex looked at the pictures for a long time. This was the Charlie of the early 1950s. Charlie doing his national service, going through the motions of being a soldier. He had never talked to her about that period of his life, except to say that he had done 1 year at Cambridge, and was then forced to do military service before returning to his beloved law. Suddenly, Bex realized that she was starting to droop over the prints, that sleep was coming quickly, so she shuffled back to the bedroom, threw off the robe, and climbed between the sheets, dropping sweetly into the healing balm of oblivion, only to be shaken roughly awake by the clamour of the telephone. As she reached out dopily for it, she saw the luminous dial of her watch, telling her it was a little after 4:30 in the wee smalls. Who the hell, she wondered. It was Patsy Wright, wide awake and worried. We're going up to ring Maruki as soon as they can file a flight plan. Our man on the island has just sent up a distress rocket. I'll be outside in 15 minutes.